Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. This is not a show about science. And to know why, all you have to do is listen to this.
In order to do this correctly, one must wear a white polyester three-piece suit with a black shirt opened halfway to the navel.
Disco dancing?
Yes, but disco dancing specifically like whom?
Like John Travolta?
Exactly right. Dance like John Travolta. Women like nothing better than a man confident enough to strut his stuff Travolta style on the dance floor.
You know, I've really been suspect of some of the studies that you guys mentioned.
Oh, yeah, that's Paula Poundstone on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me with her usual skepticism about the purpose and methodology of scientific research, which explains why there is nothing scientific about her quest for human happiness chronicled in her new book. She writes, not only is happiness the most elusive of the emotions, it also has the shortest shelf life. As Paula joins us, I think you ought to tell me and Paula about your quest for happiness. With whatever hard-earned wisdom that you have, tell us about a place and a time that you were supremely happy. And tell us why. Maybe it's with your cats. Maybe it's on a wonderful trip. You tell us, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Paula Poundstone's new book is titled The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. She'll be at the Fitz tomorrow. There's a few tickets left. She's with us today from Culver City, California. Paula, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks so much, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
I have one question for you. You know what it is?
No.
Why do you hate science?
I don't hate science.
I know you don't.
I love science. And by the way, science is not just for Democrats. I am often suspicious, however, of the studies that Peter comes up with. He had one time he said, cats were the only animals that don't forgive.
I heard that.
And that has to be questioned. I said, first of all, I think my cats forgive me, number one, A, because I feed them. But also, how do you know when a rhino has forgiven you? That's just an absurd. And I could never get any information out of him about how they did the study. By the way, Carrie, I'm actually about to launch in July my own podcast with NPR called Live from the Poundstone Institute, where I will finally, among other things, get a chance to talk to the scientists who do these studies, because Peter is not forthcoming with the information.
So what kinds of things do you want to know from these scientists that you can't get from Peter or anybody else?
I like to know how they did the study. I like to know why they did this study. Usually, Peter just has this sort of. Peter has the result. He doesn't have he doesn't have
the methodology
started,
right? Yeah,
right. Exactly. He had one time just a few weeks ago. He said at the Helsinki University or University of Helsinki. He said they had done a study where they found that. Yes, many people voted for Donald Trump for the reasons that we've all heard about. He said, but that there were a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump because he was attractive. And I couldn't even let the show go on. I said, no, stop it. Stop right there. That is either just plain not true or you have to explain to me. And he kept trying to return. He'd go, next up. But I would go, no, you go back to that. I almost had to be restrained.
Paula, I get the impression that it isn't the methodology that you're questioning. I think it's the question that they're pursuing. You don't even buy that. Like, why are they studying this stuff?
Well, that one, yeah, sure. Yeah, a lot of them. Yeah, I want to know who funded it and what was the... Yeah, why on earth would anyone even want to know that? A lot of times I think it's just, what is that called? What is that science contest they have in schools?
The science fair?
Yeah. A lot of times I think it's just the science fair gone wild. You know, it's not good advisors there in the lab.
That's how we've turned out all these scientists who want to know things that you wonder why they want to know them.
Yeah. Yeah. They are a curious bunch. I'll say that. You know, we've begun taping the podcast, and some of the, you know, some of the, there we did one just the other night where, because we taped before a live audience in Los Angeles, and we did one the other night where there was a scientist that, he was talking about the, he was trying to verify or not the 5-second rule of dropping food on the floor.
Yeah.
And so they dropped, you know, a wide variety of food on a wide variety of surfaces.
This is something I've always wanted to know, Paula. Is it right?
What, the 5-second rule?
Yes. Yeah.
No, he says that bacteria can get on food instantly. He then went on to say that all bacteria isn't bad. So you were sort of left with, it was... I said to him, okay, what about if it's dry pasta and it's spaghetti and I drop it vertically?
Yeah.
It bounces once and I catch it in my hand.
Excellent question.
I think so, because my background is pasta circus. So this is the sort of thing that could happen to me. He said, well, were you going to cook it? Because then it would eliminate the question if you're going to boil it anyways. And I think there's a lot of Italians who would say, well, you don't boil it. Is that right?
Yeah. So is his answer to this, it doesn't matter how fast you scoop it up. You've got icky stuff on it. And, hey, you're not going to die from that stuff anyway, so eat it. Don't worry about it.
No, he couldn't say what specific kind of bacteria was going to be on your surface. I had a theory at one point that you could have a very germy thing and drop it, and the bacteria would bounce off. So if you had something that was really disgusting, you just drop it on the floor and then pick it up and eat it.
But so was there any science behind that theory, or it's just something you kind of made up in your head and thought, yeah?
I just thought it was a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, no, probably no science behind. So there's very little science behind a lot of my theories. Although I will say this, maybe this isn't scientific, but if you write something in your calendar in pen, it will get canceled.
Yeah. That's unimpeachable kind of science.
I think so. Do you write in pen in your calendar?
I even do crosswords in pen, Paula.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm one of those people. I know.
Oh,
aren't we
Lordy.
Annoying? We doesn't
yeah,
mean I don't
wow.
have to go back and write over it, but yeah, I do crosswords in pen. Ridiculous.
Now, do you think it's developing your brain? I was doing it yesterday. I volunteer at a nursing home a couple mornings a week, and one of the things I bring them jigsaw puzzles.
Mm.
And yesterday I was doing one, and it had on the box, it said... it said something about challenge. It was challenge your brain and become successful. That was something that could happen according to this jigsaw puzzle box.
Yeah.
By assembling a picture of birds.
Why are you questioning
that? I was
going
to become successful.
Why are you questioning that?
I know. I wish. Well, you know, because I did complete the puzzle, and am I any more successful today than I was yesterday?
I know.
No.
Yes, you
not.
Are. Yeah, I can feel it. I can
well,
feel
you,
that
Carrie,
your success is knows no bounds.
I get to be with you, and I get to come to St. Paul.
I know.
Tomorrow night.
I know.
So those are successful things.
Get this, Paul. This is how successful you are. I said that there were some tickets available for your show. There are not. Now that's success for you. You are totally sold out at the Fitz.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that true?
It's good. Yes, that's true.
I love it there. I love the Fitzgerald Theater, although I always feel that I'm cheating on Garrison when I'm there without him.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a haunting feeling.
We're going to have to get back to him on that, see what he says.
Yeah.
Okay, so you know that I'm asking our listeners about, you know, what happiness is to them, and I call this kind of hard-earned wisdom. You know, you've lived a long life. It's not what you it wasn't the brand new car that you thought you could buy your happiness with. So what is it? And to go ahead.
Let me just explain to people that my book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, it's a series of experiments doing things that I or other people thought would make me happy. And each chapter is written as an experiment with, the conditions and the hypothesis and the, variables and qualitative and quantitative observations and hopefully the funniest field notes ever written. But the analysis section of each chapter, because my question wasn't whether I would enjoy doing something. My question was, what could I do that would give me a bounce, that would sort of build an umbrella, so to speak, for the inevitable on and off rains of one's daily life. So the analysis section of every chapter is the story of my regular life. What happens when I return, when I'm not at the gym or I'm not doing the and I'm back raising a house full of kids and animals and being a stand-up comic for a living and being stuck being me 24 hours a day. So in essence, and it took 7 years to write, just mostly because I'm slow more than anything else, I guess. It covers 7 years of raising my children. They're school age when I begin, and by the time I finish, I think there's only one at home. And it took me to some surprising places, actually.
I don't know how much qualitative and quantitative analysis there is, but. Okay.
Oh, yes, there's qualitative and quantitative observations. Yes. In fact, my first chapter is the Get Fit experiment.
Yeah.
This idea that, if you exercise a lot. And so within the quantitative observations, I was up to 500 rope jumps at one point. And that, by the way, is in a row.
Not over like 3 days.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm looking. I've got that chapter open right now, actually, and I'm looking at the field notes for that.
They were grueling workouts.
Yeah.
I took Taekwondo and self-defense.
That's right.
With this, 4-time Taekwondo world champion guy. I still remember the dull thuds of his punches on my padding.
Wait a minute.
He would shout at me what to do.
So here's what the field notes sound like, just so everybody's got the scientific truth of this. Here's what Paula wrote about that. Perhaps it was the famed endorphin boost from yesterday's arduous workout that buoyed me through the trauma of holding cat poop between my fingers at 7:05 a.m. If so, no amount of muscle strain was too much to endure. Yeah, you're getting a taste of that chapter? I think you are. All right, to the phones for happiness, to Renee in Sioux Falls. Hey, Renee, thanks so much for waiting. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering if maybe I define happiness different than she would. When you ask for these moments that would, I think back on that would make me happy. I really don't think of those moments as like a happy moment. I think of my happiness as like a kind of a general sense of my well-being. I have a good marriage. I have, thriving children. Mm-hmm. I have a rewarding career. I am financially in a good position. And so in general, I'm really happy. Like every day I'm happy. But I do feel that's also a daily choice. I think I can choose to look at all the bad and negative things going on in my life and focus more on those, but I feel like I'm happy. When you talk about a moment, I think of more of those moments as, joyful moments. Those moments were, Paula was saying, more the spikes, but I think of those as joy. But overall, I feel like happiness is a general sense of well-being.
Yeah, that's good. So, Paula, what do you make of that? Yeah,
I totally agree with you on that. There were points during the Get Fit experiment specifically, actually, there were points where, like at one point I was carrying, I was walking down the alley behind my house to the garbage, carrying about 30 pounds of kitty litter and animal waste in trash bags, taking them out to the garbage. And all of a sudden it occurred to me that I felt good. And I thought, this has to be this rigorous exercising, because I have carried animal waste in trash bags down the alley before, and I don't recall it ever making me feel good. So no, I totally agree with you. One of the things that I sort of discovered was that there was a difference between enjoying something and feeling happy. For example, I rented a Lamborghini at one point, and not because I thought it would make me happy, but because that is the classic sort of American idea of like this, you know, oh, if I had a sports car, right?
That's a Lamborghini. The man's idea of pure happiness, though, isn't it?
Well, I suppose. I mean, I don't think women think it would make you unhappy, but I guess it is sort of more of a male idea. But anyways, I tried it out, and I can't say that it made me. There were all sorts of things about it that actually bothered me, but I can't say that overall. There were times, for example, I rented it in the evening. I drove home from a class at like, I don't know, 11 o'clock or so on at night on Wilshire Boulevard through Westwood. That is kind of fun to drive even in my dented van if there's no traffic. And I rode around for a little while with my son in the car. And those moments were great. But they didn't affect my overall, just like the caller was saying, they didn't affect my overall sense of well-being. But they were great moments. But it's different. It's two different things entirely, you know. And by the way, the following day when I was driving my son to school, we had a big argument in the Lamborghini. And, you know, there was just something about a teenage boy that can make even a Lamborghini not that much fun.
Paula Poundstone is with us. If you've just tuned in, we're kind of talking about her book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Heidi says on Twitter, I wish I'd listened to this interview before I had to do my grad school research. Yeah.
So, Paula, yeah. Paula, maybe she was part of the grad school research that was doing the foods dropped on the floor, because those graduate students surely took in a lot of bacteria.
Here's one of my all-time favorite studies about happiness, and it comes from Cornell, and we did a show on this, and a scientist looked at whether experiences or things were more powerful in making us happy. So what do you think the answer is to that?
Wow, I don't know the answer to that.
Really?
I think happiness is largely a biochemical process, the kind of happiness that we're talking about. And therefore, I think it might be experiences.
You're right. So here's what the lead scientist, his name is Thomas Gilovich, said about his study to Fast Company magazine. Our experiences are a bigger part of ourselves than our material goods. You can really like your material stuff. You can even think that part of your identity is connected to those things. But nonetheless, they remain separate from you. In contrast, your experiences really are part of you. We are the sum total of our experiences. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Ooh, it's so lovely the way he says it.
It is.
Yeah, no, it does make a lot of sense. Because, you know, a lot of it, I think, is, you know, the stuff that we were always told, which is a little frustrating. I mean, I was hoping it was something more romantic than that. You know, exercise is really important to feeling good. It just is. Probably because of our evolution. Probably because I heard I listened to the book Brain Rules in my car, and that author says that we walked on average 12 miles a day when we were in the Serengeti.
Wow.
Let me just say that I have dropped that average. I am screwing up the curve in modern life. I did buy, actually, because of that author, I bought a treadmill desk, but I forget to turn it on.
Uh-huh.
So I do at least stand while I work, but I often don't actually move still. But yeah, so things like that. My volunteering chapter I did one of the chapters. This is called the Get Up and Help chapter. And I did all sorts of volunteering. I was giving platelets, donating platelets. I was and I began volunteering at a nursing home. And I'm not sure that it would matter what specifically I did. Just that a feeling that you're living a life of purpose,
right?
And looking at things beyond oneself is good for you.
We got a tweet, Paula, from an organization called Doing Good Together, and they say to you, "Good job volunteering with seniors, Paula Poundstone. Studies show such acts of service do indeed increase one's sense of happiness." So do you think that's a good study to have?
Well, I think I got a little happiness just hearing that tweet. I think there's obviously, you know, the world at this point is like a big party that we have to clean up from. You can pitch in almost anywhere, and you're going to be making some sort of a difference. You know, there's at arm's length, even from the floor, there's pizza boxes and beer cans everywhere you look, and it's time to clean up. So yeah, there's a lot of things you can do. I actually selected going to a nursing home because that was my biggest fear.
Oh, really?
I'm really scared of old people.
Oh,
yeah. Just old people in general and anything kind of medically. But old people. And
what's so scary about old people?
I don't know. They can be cranky. And I don't know. They just scare me. And then it occurred to me, since I'm, you know, really headed in that direction, it might be a good idea to familiarize myself with it a little bit more. And in fact, what I found, you know, there is the occasional cranky old person that I deal with, but I don't know. You know, there's people where I volunteer that literally have no one. Their friends and relatives are dead. And I like going and seeing them. I like talking to them and doing puzzles with them.
So now you've just reminded me. Do you think living? We all want to live a long, fruitful, full life, right? But do you think you can outlive happiness to some degree? Because you may end up exactly as you've just described. You've outlived your friends and your family, the people.
Yes, there's no question in my mind that that is the case. We don't do end of life very well at all. And I don't have the solution. I have no idea what the answer is because, you know, obviously it brings up really thorny questions. But, you know, this place that I go to, everybody who works there is busy. Working hard,
mm-hmm.
genuinely cares about the people for whom they are caring, and still, it's an inadequate solution for end of life. I just don't know what the answer is. I know that, my kids are planning on cremating me, by the way, and I am begging them to wait.
Is this something you've talked about with your kids?
Not very much. My son had the nerve to ask me what he gets when I die. I said, debt, and I want you to have it. Yeah, no, I don't, you know, I'm not a person who thinks very far down the road, and I'm not saying that is a good thing in any way. I don't think it is a good thing. I really don't. It didn't occur to me that I would be 57, for heaven's sakes, which is what I became. I don't have... You know those financial planning commercials that are forever on television?
Oh, yeah.
In all these years, I think my brain would shut down before they even got to what the commercial was about. Because it would show these gray-haired people, usually in the water, by the way. They are canoeing or kayaking or scuba diving or walking on the beach.
These aren't the people in the tubs, are they?
No, not
no,
the
that's
tub
a different
people.
Commercial,
that I relate
it?
To. That I'm like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. No, they're people. They're out in the water somewhere. They're sometimes they're doing the one with the pole where you're on the board with the pole.
Yeah,
or they're on a sailboat. Apparently, we get to an age where we just take to the water. But when I would see these ads, I would think, okay, well, that's not me, and therefore my brain would shut down. I wouldn't even think about what they were saying. And one day, maybe about 2 years ago, I happened to listen for the first time I ever did, and they said something about, you know, planning financially for retirement, and I went, oh my God, I was supposed to plan. And now I'm in big trouble.
Paula, listen to this. So Melanie is listening to us from Tucson, Arizona today, and she says she loves you. I just found your conversation on the web so I could listen here in Tucson, and she's a CPA. So should you need help with this, I think Melanie could step in. Hey, I want to tell you about this fun article that I found in the New York Times from 1990 about you and some other women comics. And here's what the story says about you. Listening to Paula Poundstone, 30, do her club act is like constantly tripping over your own feet. Just when you think you've figured her out, loves Pepperidge Farm cookies, has cats, is bored by sports, she'll mournfully plop onto her stool and wait in silence. Eventually, she may feel moved to say soberly to a member of the audience, "You look like the queen, ma'am." Do you remember that act that you did?
It's my act is sort of the same.
Is it?
Basically?
Well.
I don't mean that it's the same in that you hear the same jokes. It's more of me. My act is largely autobiographical, so things shift in terms of what I'm doing, I suppose. Sometimes I pull an old story from when my kids were little or even before I had kids, but it's sort of like making a cake, I think. You know, I start with, you know, I begin with the dry ingredients and then I fold in the new stuff. Or maybe that's why my cakes never come out. Maybe it's supposed to be the other way around. I talk about raising a house full of kids and animals. I talk about trying to pay attention to the news well enough to cast a halfway decent vote. But my favorite part of the night is just talking to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And in this way, little biographies of audience members emerge, and I use that from which to set my sails. So the truth is, every show is different. I never quite know what I'm going to talk about. I mean, some of the stories, I sort of lay out the basics. You know, I mean, you have to know, I have to give a little biography of the children in order for people to know who I'm talking about. So I don't remember someone looking like the queen, but it's certainly not beneath me to point it out if I see it.
And what I'm hearing here is the content of your act changes, obviously, as your life changes, but the idea of who you are as a comic has not changed that much, which is why it seems so genuine and authentic, right?
Yes, I think that's true. I remember, you know, when I was young, I used to do this bit about hating babies on the airplane. It used to really make me mad that people traveled with babies. And I was quite sincere about that. I would say, you know, given that they know what causes babies now, if you're thinking of taking a trip, don't have sex.
Very reasonable.
And now I must say, I am the polar opposite. Whenever there's babies at the gate, I hope that I'm going to be sitting beside them.
Seriously?
I love babies. I just love babies. And babies tend to like me, actually, which maybe it's because I'm willing to be more silly publicly than most people might be. I don't know. I was on an airplane one time and there was a lady and I believe, and this is just a guess, but I believe that she was from an African country. She did not speak English. And it was, she was across the aisle from me, and she had a kid that looked to be about one, maybe. And the kid was screaming and screaming, and you could just feel the tension on the plane. And so I leaned over and I asked her if she wanted me to help. And I don't know how she knew what I was saying, given the language barrier. But I sat down beside her and she fell asleep. And, they, you know, it was clear that she'd been traveling for a long time.
Yeah.
And I entertained that baby with language, but, you know, I don't think the kid knew what I was saying. We had the best time. And as the passengers left the plane, people leaned over and thanked me. and little did they know I couldn't have been happier. There, give me happiness.
There. You know, I feel like we have to give equal time to crabby old people because Carol has called. Hi, Carol.
Uh-oh. Hi. I'm 102 years old. And
you're not.
Carol has been one of my favorite people, but I have a bone to pick with you. We are not crabby. I'm not a crabby person, and we do not outlive happiness. I have several friends who are in the 90s, and we have fun, and we're still contributing.
Well, good for you, Carol. I stand corrected. And by the way, I don't think for a moment that every old person is a crabby old person.
Oh,
that's
I think
not true
that's pretty much what you said, Polly. Yeah, I'm on
no,
Carol's
that
side
was my,
on this.
Okay, wait, back up. That was my fear. Not that everyone was,
that's
but
right.
that I would encounter some. That was my fear. And I have to say that my fear has been, well, not entirely put to rest, to be honest with you, Carol, but largely put to rest. But that's why I decided to volunteer in a nursing home, because I wanted to educate myself further on something that fear was putting me off from. And boy, you are an inspiration, Miss 102-year-old.
102, Carol.
That's insane.
Heard us. Maybe Carol's going to be at the show tomorrow night at the Fitz.
I hope so. Thank
I
you, Carol.
I hope so, too. Paula, this has been a pleasure. Please come back anytime. Good to have you here.
All right. Thanks a lot, Carrie.
Paula Poundstone's book is called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. She might be talking about it tomorrow night at the Fitz for a sold out show. If you missed this show, you can find it on the podcast.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.